The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. There's a lot of talk about brains these days. We've said on more than one occasion on this show that studying the brain is one of the big challenges for the 21st century. One of the people charting this frontier is the journalist and science writer Jonah Lehrer. His background is in neuroscience, but his mission as a writer has tended to look at the areas where science, brains, and culture intersect. His latest book is called Imagine. In it, he delves into our attempts to understand something that's both ubiquitous yet intangible in human culture, the nature of creativity. Indeed, the book's subtitle is How Creativity Works. In this extended interview, I asked Jonah to lay out his thesis, to tease out how the hard study of brain cells can give insights into the creation of music, a great novel, or even the answer to a tricky puzzle. I started by asking Jonah what he thought creativity was.
I think creativity is just a new idea that has a second life. And a second life means maybe it's useful, maybe it's beautiful, but it's that someone else somewhere finds it interesting enough to think about. So it's a new idea, which is often a new connection between old ideas that finds a niche in the world.
And you start the book in the introduction with the development of a new type of mop. Yeah. And then the first chapter is about one of the greatest pop songs, rock songs of all time. And these things are both, in your definition, creative. How do you equate a new mop with Bob Dylan?
Well, because they're both new ideas, right? They're both bringing new things into
them.
The world.
Take us through them and tell us what the parallels are.
Sure. So the invention of this new kind of mop begins when a team of chemists at Procter & Gamble, and at the time Procter & Gamble had more PhDs on staff than any other company in the world, they're trying to come up with a new line of soaps for their mops. And these chemists spend several years trying to develop a stronger line of soaps, but it turns out to be a very difficult thing to do because you develop stronger soaps and they irritate delicate skin, they peel the varnish off wood floors, and so on. So after 2 years of expensive chemistry failures, Procter & Gamble decides to outsource this problem to a design firm called Continuum, full of engineers. These engineers know that, you know, they're not going to know more about chemistry than the chemists back at Procter & Gamble, so they decide to spend the first 9 months watching people mop their floors. And what they discover after watching people mop their floors for 9 months, and I've seen this footage, and it's even more tedious than you can imagine, is that mopping is a terrible idea. That people actually spend more time cleaning their cleaning tool than they do cleaning the actual floor.
So they spent hours watching people mopping floors?
Yes, for 9 months. So they spent 8 hours a day for 9 months watching people mop. And they realized that mopping was a horrible technology. And that's largely because companies like Procter & Gamble had devoted decades to coming up with all these different mop fibers that were great at getting dirt off the floor, but made it very tough to get the dirt out of the mop head. So you watch people just in these narrow bathtubs, you know, trying to get the mop clean, but they can't. So they end up splashing dirty water on the floor. So then these designers and engineers go back to Procter & Gamble and say, we haven't solved your problem. We just realized it's even worse than you think. Of course, the company says, guys, it's not helpful. You have one more month to find an answer. One of their last house visits, they watch an elderly lady clean up some coffee grinds on the floor. And although she said she loved to vacuum, she loved to mop, that's not how she picked up these coffee grinds. Instead, she tore off a paper towel, wet the paper towel, and ran along the floor. And in that moment, they suddenly had their moment of insight. They suddenly realized, aha, this is what we need to do. We need the pole of a mop, but instead of having mop heads, you have disposable cleaning surface. And that became the Swiffer, which is now a, you know, multi-billion-dollar-a-year product, especially in the States. It's very, very popular. And tests show it actually cleans the floor better than a mop. So that's one new idea. And I think what the Swiffer shows us about creativity is it's not a single thing, right? We call it creativity as if there was just one way to be creative. But creativity is really a catch-all term for a variety of distinct thought processes. That sometimes you need to spend 9 months watching people mop the floor, and that's part of the creative process. That prepares you for that sudden epiphany that comes when you watch the lady just pick up the coffee grinds. The creativity, you know, I think we've in a sense oversimplified it, that it's really just a bundle of distinct mental processes, each of which is essential at different parts of the process.
And so this is the idea of making connections that haven't been made before. If you can go on to Bob Dylan then. Yeah. You describe in detail about the process of him writing Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And again, this is about making connections that never been made before.
Yeah. So for Bob Dylan, this is May 1965. He's really at this point sick of being in the spotlight by himself. He is sick of being a folk singer. He is sick of the expectation, sick of this burden of being this political poet. And he tells his manager after his last shows in London in May 1965 that he is quitting the music business. He is done with the singing and songwriting. He's going to move to a tiny cabin in Woodstock, New York, and he's going to paint and write novels. He's there for a couple days when he feels this familiar feeling, what he calls the itch of unwritten words. And then he starts to scribble. He just gets out a pencil and paper and starts to write these words down. His hand doesn't stop moving for the next several hours. He describes it as this act of vomiting forth these associations. He describes it, the ghost is in charge, and the ghost is having him write down words. He doesn't know what they mean. And you know, for Dylan, this was a new way of writing a song. And so he spends the next several hours scribbling down these lyrics, 25 pages in all, and somewhere within these 25 pages, he commits the chorus to paper. And as soon as he writes down the chorus, he knows this is it, and it's the chorus to Like a Rolling Stone. The very next week, he takes those words, this sheaf of lyrics, into the cramped space of Studio A at Columbia Records in New York City and records Like a Rolling Stone. It's cut on acetate on the very fourth take. And of course, this is 6 minutes of raw music that would revolutionize rock and roll. And I think what this process opened up for Dylan was, here he was so frustrated, felt like a failure, had literally given up, and that freed him to get away from it for a little bit. And that's when he was able to, I think for the very first time, take all these influences, all these voices, all these songs he loved in his head, and blend them together, combine Woody Guthrie and Robert Johnson and Brecht and Blake, and blur them together into a new kind of rock and roll song.
So pinpoint for me, if you can, and this is, it might be a sort of strange question, but pinpoint for me where the moment of flash of insight was and what was going on in his brain at the time. Yeah. You can't possibly know because we didn't scan.
Yeah, no. Obviously, I'm, you know, it's tough to reverse engineer Bob Dylan's thought process. But you know, he describes the phenomenology of writing Like a Rolling Stone in very clear terms of having a moment of insight, that he wasn't thinking about Like a Rolling Stone. He wasn't even trying to write a song. The answer came out of the blue. And as soon as it arrived, he knew this was it. That's why he was writing it down. And that's why the very next week he took it into the studio. And those are the two defining features of a moment of insight as outlined by cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists over the last decade, which is that the answer arrives when we least expect it. And as soon as the solution arrives, we know this is the solution. It feels like a revelation. You know, at first glance, it's not quite clear how one could scientifically study such moments of insight because, you know, you can't just put undergraduates in a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany, we're ready for you. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, scientists had to come up with a way to generate lots of moments of insight on the fly. And one technique, which was pioneered by Mark Beeman at Northwestern University and John Kunios at Drexel, was to give people a set of word problems called compound remote associate problems. The acronym is a bit unfortunate, CRAP. But the word problems consist of three words, such as pine, crab, and sauce. And you have to find the fourth word that can form a compound word with those. So an answer here would be apple, pineapple, crabapple, applesauce. So if apple leaps into consciousness, it's almost certainly going to arrive in one of these flashes of insight. So the first thing they discovered, this by putting about 75 subjects inside an fMRI machine, so a big N, the seconds before an insight appeared, they saw a sharp spike in activity in an obscure part of the right hemisphere called the anterior superior temporal gyrus, just behind the ear. And this is a part of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors. And what Beeman and Kunios argue is that makes sense, that all these activities require the brain to bring together a distal set of connections. That when Romeo says that Juliet is the sun, we know he's not saying that Juliet's a big flaming ball of gas. Instead, we're able to see past the surface dissimilarities, the fact that Juliet and sons have literally nothing in common, and instead find those remote associations they actually share. And the same thing is required when we're trying to make sense of pine, crab, and sauce. You know, those aren't three words that go together very frequently. And yet, this one brain area seems to be particularly good at finding this one other word, which in this case is apple, that binds them all together.
In that particular example, it might well be a flash of insight that gives you Apple, but also you could just try lots of words. Why is one more creative than the other, or is one not creative?
No. I think creativity is about the solution. There are many different parts of the process. There are many different ways to get to the new idea. I think the thing that matters, the thing that defines creativity, is the new idea itself. So one of the, I think, ingenious things about giving people compound remote associated problems as a methodology is that these word problems aren't always solved in a moment of insight. That sometimes people solve them through this, you know, analytical brute force approach where they go through lots and lots of different words. And that's equally possible. You know, you can do that.
You still call that maybe a creative solution then?
Of course. It's the solution that counts. But because these word problems can be solved in these two distinct ways, Beeman and Cuneo's could begin to isolate the particular neural mechanics that define moments of insight. So even though people come up with Apple, some people solve it analytically and you see very different patterns of brain activation than those who say, oh man, I have no idea. Wait, Apple, aha. So then you see a different kind of brain activation.
So you mentioned one part of the brain that is behind the ear, which it seems to be implicated in understanding metaphors and, as you said, jokes, yeah, and being creative, things that you associate with creativity anyway,
yeah,
in an artistic sense. What other significant parts of the brain are we learning about, given that in the last few decades we're learning so much about the brain and different bits of it doing different things? What's implicated in creativity?
So there is the inspiration side, and I think we tend to associate the inspiration side with these romantic moments of insight, those revelations in the shower and, you know, on the hike, and these answers that arrive when we least expect it. And this is the counterintuitive thing about moments of insight, is that they are associated with alpha waves, which is something you can record using EEG, and alpha waves are associated with states of relaxation. So we're much more likely to have a moment of insight when we are not sitting at our desk staring at a computer screen. Possibly asleep, possibly taking a nap.
I knew it was a good thing to do.
Possibly drunk. You know, just last month a study came out showing that undergraduates who were too drunk to drive solved 30% more of these difficult creative
puzzles.
You're
advocating sleeping and drinking a lot.
Well, maybe drinking before sleeping, maybe having a beer before the shower. But the science does scramble a lot of our conventional notions on what productivity looks like, that sometimes our best ideas arrive only after we stop looking
for
them.
You say that, but I think most students already know that, and rock stars already know they're getting drunk.
Absolutely. This is not a problem for rock stars. Rock stars know this in their bones. I think it's a problem for the modern workplace.
Go back to the other bits then. So,
you know, there is this inspiration side, and then there's the perspiration side. And when you talk to creative people, they often begin by telling these great stories about their epiphanies. And then if you keep on pressing them, they'll talk about all the perspiration that came after, all the hard work that they had this breakthrough, and then they still need to edit it and go through revision after revision, iteration after iteration. There's nothing too fun about this. I mean, in fact, the evidence suggests it can actually make us melancholy and miserable. And this seems to involve working memory. So, you know, working memory is just your mental scratch pad. It's served by attention. It's the ideas you're thinking about at that time. And this is prefrontal areas in the brain. It's modulated by the spotlight of attention. And so things that can brighten the spotlight of attention, that's why drugs like caffeine or amphetamines, which make it easier to pay attention to tedious stuff, can increase this form of creativity. They make it easier to focus. What's interesting to me about this form of creativity is that we have this amazing ability to, when we're working on these problems and we're paying attention to them, to assess with a very high degree of accuracy whether or not we can solve them. This is called feelings of knowing, and they're pretty magical mental phenomenon. So, I mean, I can show you a variety of analytical creative problems, problems that don't require moments of insight. And you will be able to, the study suggests, this is work by Janet Metcalf, diagnose with upwards of 85% accuracy whether or not you can solve them within a given time frame. So even though you don't know what the answer is, you can say, yep, I can find that answer. It is within my grasp. And what's even more amazing is while working on that problem, while paying attention to it, you're able to say, I'm making progress here. Even though I don't know what the answer is, I know I'm getting closer to it. It's a bit like being dropped into a strange city. You have no idea where you're trying to get to, and you're able to say, if I make this left-hand turn, I'm heading in the right direction. Totally spooky, and I think these are very motivational feelings, and they keep, you know, they're the mind telling us, keep on working on this. So the best advice I think science can give us at the moment is, if you've got a feeling of knowing, keep on drinking coffee. Chug that Red Bull. Do whatever it is you need to do to stay late at the office, right? Because you're making progress. However, as soon as that feeling of knowing disappears, as soon as you feel like I'm not making progress, I've hit the wall, I'm Bob Dylan in May 1965, then take a long hot shower. have a beer or three.
So if you come across a particularly difficult problem, is the best thing to stop thinking about it? Because that's a recipe to carry on thinking about it, generally speaking, for most people.
Yeah, so if you come across a really difficult problem, you should begin by saying, do I have a feeling of knowing here? Like, do I think I can solve this? And you know, hopefully the answer is yes, especially in the beginning, because you can't just look at a hard problem and say, okay, I'm going to take a nap now, and then expect to wake up and suddenly have the epiphany. You generally have to put in work before you can take a break. You have to fill your head with old ideas that you can hope to connect in a new way. So when you begin working on a hard problem, I think it's almost always the case that you have to begin with some perspiration, begin by paying attention to it, and hopefully you'll make some progress. But at a certain point, what will probably happen, you know, this is just part of the creative process, is you will hit the wall. You will feel stuck and stumped and hopelessly frustrated. And that's when you want to take a break. There's this wonderful line of Einstein's that creativity is the residue of wasted time. Once you've hit the wall, once that problem suddenly seems impossible, the feeling of knowing has disappeared, you need to make time to waste time.
Now, how much can all of this stuff be tested? Brain scanning itself is developing as a technology and gets better every single year and more informative. But still, things like functional magnetic resonance imaging are correlates rather than they don't tell you anything about what that bit of the brain's doing, and different bits of the brain seem to be implicated in 10 different things. Tell me from your own point of view as a journalist and as a neuroscientist, what is the limit of understanding this stuff?
You know, it's a really important question, and these tools are all very, very limited. I think it's very important to be clear that fMRI is not some window into the mind. I've written extensively about the limitations of fMRI and EEG. And that's why in this book, you know, I just talk about 3 fMRI studies and 2 EEG studies. So this is not a book primarily about brain scans. When I do talk about brain scans, it's always in the context of multiple threads of evidence. So, for instance, I talk about, you know, one of my favorite brain scanning studies, which was an fMRI study done of jazz pianists by Charles Lim at Johns Hopkins University, very well-regarded study, where he showed that these jazz musicians, before they engage in the act of improv, they deactivate a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is just behind your forehead. And it's a part of the brain closely associated with self-control. So it allows you to raise your hand. It allows you to not say stupid stuff. It allows you to not eat all the ice cream in the freezer. So it's a very important brain area. But when you need to improvise, it's also that voice telling you not to do something, right? It's also the voice telling you, don't play that note. It'll sound bad. Don't play that melody. Don't do that. And so what these jazz musicians are able to do is, in the moment before improvising, just turn it off.
How?
This, of course, takes years and years of practice, but they're able to deactivate it on command. They make it look so easy because they work so hard. Nobody quite knows how they learn how to do this, but they've simply learned how to do it. That's what the evidence suggests. So I don't just talk about, you know, I think it's an interesting study, but it's, of course, not dispositive. It doesn't tell us, you know, doesn't tell us really what's going on. But I think when you bring other streams of evidence to bear on this, you talk about neurological patients who have suffered prefrontal injuries and how they are often very impulsive and they have difficulty paying attention, what that can teach us about this. And you talk about patients with frontotemporal dementia in which this particular brain area and the prefrontal cortex begins to disintegrate. And one of the common side effects of these patients with frontotemporal dementia is spontaneous creativity. They become compulsively creative. That here are janitors and molecular biologists and stockbrokers who have never been interested in painting or drawing before, yet they begin to suffer from this devastating disease that will eventually kill them. And for the first 5 or 10 years they have this disease, all they want to do is paint. They've never gone to a museum before, but now they can't stop painting. It's all they want to do. And that's because they've got these things they want to express. So you can talk about that. You can talk about brain development, how one of the reasons kids are so effortlessly creative is because the frontal lobes are the last part of the brain to develop. And so they begin life without that voice telling them no, which is why, you know, as Picasso put it, every child born an artist. You can talk about the neuroscience of sleep, how when we fall asleep, one of the reasons we tell these amazingly fantastical stories for 8 hours every night is because our frontal lobes quiet down. And so we're able to kind of just express the rest of the stuff going on in our brain. So you can look at this from many, many different perspectives. you know, some of which involve brain scanning, but many of which involve many other different ways of understanding the mind. I think it's that's why it's so important to bring to bear many different streams of evidence when talking about the brain. fMRI gives us one angle, but it shouldn't be the only angle.
But exploring that just a little bit further, you're talking about bits of the brain that are involved in self-control and perhaps understanding metaphors and all of that sort of stuff. That's a very mechanistic way of looking at things. And then I suppose the other way of looking at it is that here's something creative. Let's look at what's going on in the brain at the same time. One is a manifestation of the other in some respect, but the manifestation bit, the bit that we're experiencing, the great piece of music, for example, or the great artwork or whatever else, is very subjective. And what's creative to one person might be deeply uncreative to another. Yeah. So in that sense, how's the difference between those things manifested in your brain? If I think a painting is particularly creative and someone else doesn't, then the person who's created it has only got one set of neural activity going on when he's creating that thing. Is that still creative? Is that just a definitional problem?
Well, of course. I mean, making something creative is no guarantee that it's going to be universally liked or desired or appreciated. In fact, that almost never happens. I can't think of an interesting artwork that everyone likes. Making something creative, making a new idea is doesn't mean everyone's going to like it. I think a larger question here is the extent to which neuroscience is a useful even tool for thinking about these sorts of things. I would argue it's necessary. It's in no way sufficient. But here's this new way of knowing ourselves. Here's this new way of trying to grapple with subjectivity, with consciousness, with the imagination, with creativity, with beauty, with all with memory, with time and love, with all these grand mysteries, which will always be, I think, tinged with mystery. But I think neuroscience is yet another layer of description. It doesn't mean the old layers of description, those more subjective layers of description. It doesn't mean those old artistic intuitions aren't valid in any way, shape, or form. They remain just as valid and important as ever. But I think learning to look at these 3 pounds of meat inside the head just gives us a new way to understand ourselves. And to me, that's exciting.
I mean, I suppose some of the criticism of the book in the last few months online and elsewhere has been this idea of scientism, which is simply that you can explain everything. Some people believe that you can explain everything, every process, consciousness, all of these things through some molecular mechanism. What's your response to those?
I mean, that's not what this book is about in any way, shape, or form. In fact, my very first book, Proust and Neuroscience, it's all about how these intuitions of artists, Proust and memory, Cezanne and vision, often presaged, modern neuroscience, how these artists had ideas about how the mind worked, which were, I think, very, very prophetic. So I very much believe that neuroscience is not a universal explanation. It's not the only explanation we should be looking for. I think it's just another explanation. And I think one thing it's very important to always avoid in conversations about the brain is nothing but the idea that, that Rembrandt self-portrait is nothing but a, little oscillations of electricity in the V4 part of the visual cortex, or love is nothing but dopamine and oxytocin, et cetera, et cetera. I think nothing but is a terrible way to think about neuroscience, especially given how little we actually understand.
What does it give to you in terms of understanding this, these sorts of ideas? You obviously are a fan and a student of neuroscience, so this is important to you, but also of creativity. What does it give you understanding it from?
Well, so let's say creativity. People have said lots of things about creativity over the last thousands of years. I mean, we've been thinking about creativity as long as we've been having new ideas, trying to understand where they come from. We've been blaming the muses for a long time. We've had many, many beliefs about where these new ideas come from. And it seems very, very mysterious. And so some of these intuitions, I think, are wise and very interesting. And I say a lot of them in the book. I talk about Nietzsche's Apollonian and Dionysian distinction, which I think maps very neatly onto modern psychological notions of convergent and divergent thinking. I talk about Hume, I think, had some very prescient things to say about creativity. Aristotle said some beautiful things about the effect of mood on cognition. So you can mine these past thinkers and find all sorts of, I think, things which have been confirmed by modern science. And that's wonderful. But let's be clear that many of these intuitions are not true. That when people talk about the muses, there are no fickle gods up there breathing down on our head and saying, here's a new idea. That many of these ideas have not panned out. And that, there's a difference between anecdotes and data, that these intuitions are not experiments. There's a reason we had the Enlightenment, that I think science helps us clarify these intuitions. That's why it's, I think, an important part to have in the conversation.
Let's talk about science and creativity. I mean, traditionally speaking, I'm sure you don't agree with this, but there's a sort of lazy assumption that creativity involves artworks and novel writing and music and all those sorts of things, which are deeply creative things, and the science is somehow uncreative.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, scientists have to think about things that have never been thought before, fundamental physics, mathematics, etc. Is there a qualitative difference between those types of creativity?
I don't think so. And this is what I think makes the brain particularly interesting for these sorts of questions is the brain is a great category buster. The brain is great at taking these categories that seem so rigid in our world, you know, art and science, and showing us that actually artists and science are both engaged in this act of problem solving. And when you talk to artists, they'll often talk about it in the language of problem solving. They don't think about a painter as a problem solver in the same way we might think of a molecular biologist as solving a technical problem. And yet painters will often say, it's just something's not working here. I've got to fix this thing. It's not holding together. And so they'll experiment in their own visual aesthetic way until it works. So I think the brain, it's very fun the way it scrambles our conventional notions of how things hang together, and it tends to blur them together, and that's what interests me.
Now let's think about how these insights can be used. We've talked about where these insights might sit in the brain, but how does it help society? How does it help us to know these things?
I think it helps us in many different ways. There's this wonderful line of T.S. Eliot's when someone asked him why there are so many bad poets. And he says, well, bad poets are conscious when they should be unconscious and unconscious when they should be conscious. And so I think one of the things that we can begin to extract from this neuroscience, from this new science of creativity, is that it can help us make sure we're thinking in the right way at the right time. So I think the science can give us tools to diagnose our creative problems, to use our feelings of knowing to say, you know, should I be drinking caffeine right now or a beer? Should I be staying late at the office or taking a shower, going for a walk or, you know, chained to my desk? And then we can try to adjust our thought process to the task at hand. And really what we can do is, you know, use our attention, try to make sure we're paying attention to the right sorts of things, and really use the environment to our advantage. Because the environment has profound effects on how you're thinking, on how you're feeling. And so that's going to change exactly what kind of thoughts you're going to have.
Where's your most creative moment? Is it in the shower or is it when you're drunk? What happens?
Did
you write this book drunk? I'm hoping not.
No. The shower is pretty good, I think, in large part because it's for me like the one place you can't take your phone. So you're kind of forced to have 5 minutes of daydreaming time, and daydreams turn out to be an incredibly productive mental state. That some studies estimate our brain consumes more energy while daydreaming than it does when we're focused.
I'd love to know one of the insights you've had in the shower or daydreaming. Tell us something that has resulted in something that people might know about.
Nothing directly in this book. When I was in the shower, actually, I had a New Yorker piece. It came out a couple months ago on E.O. Wilson and his theories of inclusive fitness. And I couldn't think of how to actually structure the article. You know, it was a very technical piece involving kind of mathematical biology. And I knew I had to find some way to make these different views of where altruism came from tangible. And so it was in the shower that I suddenly realized I should begin every section with a story of altruism, a story of vampire bats who barf blood into the mouths of basically others in the colony, total strangers who they're not related to, and they are vomiting blood into the mouth of these other bats. So that's actually how I began the article. And then I talk about woodpeckers who stay around the nest and help raise their younger siblings, even though they're mature and should start their own nest. So I realized, you know, that's one way to make it come alive. And that came while I was shampooing my hair. So that for me, you know, is a testament to the power of the shower. In general, though, I'm a hiker. And one way this book has changed my own work process, I used to have this very puritanical notion that when I was stuck and stumped, when I didn't know how to finish a sentence or begin a paragraph, that what I needed to do was to, you know, stay up late, drink another cup of coffee, and just power on through. Then, of course, you know, as a writer, you wake up the next day and you realize your fixes haven't fixed anything and you just delete the whole thing. And then you're even worse off because now you're exhausted. And so now when I'm really frustrated, I just go for a walk. And that's been helpful for me.
At the risk of ending on a self-help note, And I know this is not a self-help book.
I don't mind calling it a self-help book.
You don't?
I mean, I think the problem I have with most self-help books is they make it seem easy. I think as long as you're very upfront about, like, creativity will never be easy, no matter how much you know about neurons or cities, that it will always be very, very hard and require tons of work and persistence and grit and all the rest, then fine.
Okay, well, in that case, let's call it a self-help book where you have to work very, very, very hard. Indeed.
Yes.
What is your when someone's going to come up to you and say, how do I maximize my creativity? What do you say to them?
Yeah. Work really, really hard.
apart from that.
I mean, that's the best single answer. I mean, when you try to figure out, like, what defines very successful creative people, right? Like, what separates Bob Dylan and Pablo Picasso and Steve Jobs and the rest of us? For a long time, this has been a big mystery within psychology, because you can give them IQ tests, they're not smarter than the rest of us, and give them a battery of old-fashioned personality tests, and they're not really different than the rest of us. They may be a touch more open to experience, but that's about it. But it turns out that they are largely defined by this new character trait called grit, G-R-I-T. It's been pioneered by Angela Duckworth, and she sees this character trait in lots of highly successful people, and field after field, it seems to be the single best predictor of success. And grit's about single-mindedness and persistence. Those are the two domains that define grit. So it's like J.K. Rowling, who suffered through 12 rejections from publishers, but kept on writing about Harry Potter, this boy wizard, in coffee shops while her baby daughter napped. I mean, that right there is grit. And that's the defining feature of, I think, a lot of very successful creative people. And that's really because in the 21st century, coming up with a new idea is always going to be damned hard. If it were easy, that thing would already exist, right? That poem would have been written, that patent would have been filed, that gadget would have been invented. So coming up with something new is going to involve frustration and failure and red pen on the page and people telling you you're not good enough, that you're not cut out for this. This idea will never, ever, ever work. And to make it through, to be successful, to really bring this idea you had in the shower into the real world, that's going to take persistence. It's going to take almost like a silly single-mindedness. And that's what we call grit. So if I was forced to choose one thing to, you know, to say work on if you want to maximize your creativity, it's build up your grit.
Joan O'Lara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Imagine How Creativity Works by Joan O'Lara is published in the UK by Canongate and is available in all good bookshops. That's it for this creative edition of Science Weekly. See what I did there? You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.